The first 11 verses of Isaiah chapter 40 are a perfect summary of the message of the gospel. Verse 1 there, it says, comfort ye my people, saith your God, speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The gospel really is a great announcement from God, a message of comfort for us, telling us of his great way of deliverance for us from the captivity of sin. He has sent his only begotten Son into the world to do for us what we could never ever do for ourselves, that is, save us from our lost sinful condition. In verse 12, and we're going to be looking tonight at verses 12 through to 17, and in these verses, the prophet gives us a view of the greatness and majesty of God. And the poetic language here is truly inspiring. We're given a picture of the awesomeness, the grandeur, and the greatness of God. We're brought face to face here with God himself. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, if we only had some faint conception of God, there would be no need to argue about sin. If we only saw ourselves as we are in the sight of God, why, we would fly to repentance. And if we only understood something of the nature and being of God, and ourselves face to face with him, far from stumbling at the incarnation, we would thank God for it as the only thing that can save us. So you see how necessary it is that we have a right view and a right understanding of God himself. If we only had that, we would have no problem in believing and accepting the gospel. Do you know the reason why there are so many people all around us tonight who do not believe or accept the gospel? It comes down to the fact that they do not know who God is. They do not realize who God is in all of his majesty, in all of his glory, in all of his holiness. And if we have a right view and a right understanding of God, it leads us to do but one thing, and that is to fly to him in repentance and in faith in Christ. And that is why the prophet holds before us here this picture of the awesomeness, grandeur, and greatness of God himself. Verse 12, it says, who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with the span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? Who is the prophet talking about here? He's talking about God. You know, we must always start with God. Because we are sinful, self-centered beings, we always start with ourselves. We think first of all about our problems, about our unhappiness, our lack of peace, our fears, and so on. But folks, that's not where the gospel starts. The gospel is not a message that tells you, are you unhappy? Here's something that will make you happy. Or are you having problems? Well, here's something that will cure all of your problems for you. No, that's not the gospel. The gospel always starts with God himself. If you have a right understanding about God, if you're rightly related to him, then all of these other things will follow on from that. If you truly know God, you will have peace, you will have happiness, you will have grace to face the trials of life. But you see, it all starts with God. That's why the Bible itself starts with God. What is the very first phrase in the Bible? In the beginning, God. That's where it all starts. All the problems in the world, all of the problems in our personal lives, all stem from the fact that we do not know God. We do not have a right relationship with God. It's vital that we understand that. For the prophet here in these verses brings us face to face with God himself. And there are three things that these verses, from verses 12 through to 17, three things that the prophet shows us here about God. First of all, he shows us the greatness and the power of God. The greatness and the power of God. Look at verse 12 again. It says, "Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with a span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance?" What a majestic view of God we have here. And in this verse there are basically four things that the prophet tells us about God. He tells us he's the one who measures the waters in the hollow of his hand. He's the one who metes out the heavens with a span. He's the one who comprehends the dust of the earth in a measure. And he's the one who weighs the mountains and the scale, and mountains and the hills in scales and in a balance. You know, one of the nice things about living in the country that we live in is that we're never too far from the ocean. All of us here have been to the ocean, haven't we? When we lived in the States a number of years ago for a year in Missouri in the center of the States, we met people who had never seen the ocean before. Imagine that. But the next time you stand at the seaside and look out at the ocean, think of the vast volume of water that's out there in the ocean. If you were to sail across the Atlantic and see those thousands upon thousands of miles of seemingly limitless waters, a vast, vast amount and volume of water, isn't it? And what does the prophet tell us here about God? God holds it in the hollow of his hand and can measure it. Imagine God can hold those vast ocean waters in the hollow of his hand, and he knows exactly the volume of water that's in them. Think of the sky. Look at the sky, that vast expanse that reaches as far as you can see. You travel around the world and you never come to the end of the sky. It's vast, it's limitless. What does the prophet tell us here? The prophet tells us that God is able to measure it with his hand. God can hold his hand, as it were, up against the sky, and he can tell exactly the measurements that the sky is. Or look at all of the particles of dust that are found in all the world. Could we ever count them? Absolutely not. What does the prophet tell us here that God can do? God can take every particle of dust that's found in the world, and he can place them in a cup and he can count every one of them. Or look at the vast mountains and mountain ranges that there are in the world. Think of Mount Everest, that vast mountain that only the most experienced of climbers can reach the top of. And what does the prophet tell us here? God can take those mountains, he can set them, as it were, upon a pair of scales, and he can tell exactly their weight. What a majestic, powerful God that we have. Verse 15, it says, "Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing." In verse 17, "All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity." You know, we're always being bombarded with the greatness of the nations, aren't we? You turn on your news and you hear constantly about the greatness of the nations of the world. We talk about the great nations, and in human terms, they are great. There are presidential elections being held this week in the United States, and there are two men who have poured millions of dollars into their presidential campaign. Why? Because each of them wants to be the president of a great and a powerful nation in our world. There's great power in the nations. We see them sitting down in their great conferences and looking at great events in the world and controlling things that are happening in the world. But what does the prophet tell us here about God in relation to the nations? Before the greatness of God, the nations are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. Now, what can possibly be less than nothing? In miles, if you subtract something from nothing, you're into the minus. That's how God sees the great nations of the world tonight. Less than nothing. We look at the nations of the world. We see their great military might. We see their tanks and their armies and their weapons and so on. And we fear another world war, don't we, whenever we look at the military might of the nations. But what is God, how does God view them? He says they are counted as the small dust of the balance. It's like whenever you take a pair of scales, maybe you ladies are going to bake something, and you take your scales and you want a very accurate measurement, so you wipe off any dust that's on them, and maybe there's one little speck that's left. Well, that's how God views the nations of the world. That's how God sees them. Folks, we are face to face here with the power and the greatness of God. God is the great creator and sustainer of everything. He is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. He is the great God of infinite power, the one who spoke these very worlds into being by the word of his power. He simply said, "Let there be light," and there was light. He's the one who controls the entire universe and everything that's happening in it. Think of the earth spinning around in space. Think of all of the galaxies and this massive and powerful universe. God upholds it all by his mighty power. He upholds it and sustains it all from day to day. What a mighty God we have. You see, our greatest problem, the greatest problem that people have, is that they have such a little view of God. We start off in life with a very little view of God. As children, we have this conception of God as some kind of old man, much like ourselves, up there in the sky somewhere. And sadly, many adults don't move far beyond such a view of God. He's just someone up there they can call upon whenever they're in trouble. They can look to him and he will maybe give them the things that they want. It's tragic, folks, that we have such a little view of God. The prophet brings us here face to face with this almighty, great and powerful God. Someone has said it is because we have not taken the shoes off our feet and realized that the God who made the world could blow upon us and make us vanish in a second, that we speak as we do and stumble as we do at his glorious salvation. And here's the thing that I want you to get tonight. As we think of the greatness and the power of God, God is of such infinite power that he has taken the problem of your sin and mine, that unconquerable barrier that stands between us and himself, that keeps us out of a living relationship with him, that unconquerable barrier that shuts heaven's door fast in our face. God is of such infinite power that he has taken that problem of our sin and he has dealt with it by laying all of that sin upon his dearly beloved Son, whom he sent to Calvary's cross. And there in his Son he has dealt with that awful problem of our sin that separates us eternally from him. And folks, that's the gospel tonight. God in his infinite power doing for you and for me what we could never ever do for ourselves. That problem of sin that separates us from God, that keeps us out of a living relationship with him, that keeps us out of heaven. God has taken that problem and in his Son he has dealt with it and dealt with it eternally. My dear friend, tonight you've got to simply believe that through the cross of Christ, God has dealt with the great problem of your sin. And all you've got to do tonight is cast yourself at the feet of this almighty God, acknowledging that you can never save yourself, that there's nothing you could ever do that will enable you to earn his favour, because he and he alone, because he's an infinitely all-powerful God, has dealt already with the problem of your sin. No, all you have to do tonight then is to cast yourself at his feet and to trust in that great provision that he has made for you in the cross of Christ. I trust if you're here, you're listening to this word tonight, oh, that you might realize that in the presence of this almighty and powerful, all-powerful God, you are absolutely nothing and can do nothing to ever earn his favor, but that he, in the cross of Christ, has dealt with your sin and has made it possible for you to be reconciled to him and to be in his heaven with him forever. So that's the first thing that the prophet holds before us and shows us here, the greatness and the power of God. But the second thing that the prophet shows us here about God is the glory and holiness of God. The glory and the holiness of God. Look at verse 16. It says, "And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering." What is the prophet saying here? Lebanon was a great mountain. It had great forests that were filled with mighty trees. The Bible talks about the cedars of Lebanon. They were tall, majestic trees that reached up to the very heavens. And what the prophet is saying here is this, that if you were to cut down every one of those trees in those great and mighty forests there in Lebanon, if you were to chop up every one of those trees and you were to light them as a sacrifice, or if you were to take all of the animals that were to be found in those great forests and you were to offer all of them up as a burnt sacrifice to God, all of that would not be sufficient. All of that would not be enough to enable you to be reconciled to God, enable you to approach him and to be accepted by him. Why? Because God is so infinitely glorious and holiness that we can't even begin to approach him. It doesn't matter if we were to cut down all of the trees in the world, if we were to gather all of the animals in the world together and offer them as a sacrifice. It would be absolutely insufficient to enable us to be accepted by God. You see, God is so infinitely holy, and we are so sinful that we are infinitely apart. I wonder, friend, have you ever realized that about yourself? You who think that by your good works and the good things that you do, by your good deeds that you perform in life, that you can somehow make yourself acceptable to God. I wonder, have you ever realized that God is so infinitely holy and you are so sinful that you are infinitely apart? 1 Timothy 6 and 16, it says, "Who only hath immortality dwelling in the light, which no man can approach unto, whom no man hath seen nor can see, to whom be honour and power everlasting." Turn back to Isaiah chapter 6 for a moment. Isaiah chapter 6 is a wonderful vision that the prophet had of God. Verse 2 there of chapter 6, we're told that he saw the seraphims, those mighty angels who surround the throne of God. We're told that they cover their faces with their wings. Then in verse 3 it says, "One cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The thrice holy God is so infinitely holy that the very angels in his presence cannot even look upon him. They have to veil their faces. Exodus 15 and verse 11, it says, "Who is like unto thee, O Lord, glorious in holiness?" The prophet brings us here face to face with the glory and the holiness of God. I believe that we have lost that sense of the holiness of God. In our low view of God, we have some vague notion of Him as someone who loves us and is kind and merciful to us. But His glory and His holiness we rarely consider. Isaiah, whenever he had that great vision of the thrice holy God there in chapter 6 and saw his glory filling the earth, what was the prophet's reaction? It says in verse 5, "Then said I, woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips." He felt undone in the presence of this almighty, glorious, infinitely holy God. Why? Because he was sinful and unclean. In the presence of such holiness, Isaiah the prophet felt his own uncleanness. Folks, this is what a vision of God in all his holiness will do. It will cause us to see how sinful we are, how utterly unworthy we are to stand in his presence, and how absolutely nothing that we can ever do will enable us to be accepted by him. Verse 16, it says, "And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering." Nehemiah penned those words, "Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small." Because God is absolutely holy, in all his eternal glory, he must deal with the problem of sin. Do many people have the mistaken notion somehow that God is just going to overlook their sin? That somehow at the end of the day, God is just going to smile upon us all, let us all into heaven as we are, that God is just going to overlook the problem of sin. But folks, because God is an infinitely holy God, he cannot do that. He has got to punish sin. He has got to deal with sin. And no sacrifice that we could ever offer to God is sufficient for the problem of our sin. Even if it were all the trees and all the animals in the world put together, totally insufficient for such an infinitely holy God. That's why, friends, there is only one acceptable sacrifice. And that is the sacrifice that God himself has made for us on our behalf. God offered his own pure, sinless Son as that one sacrifice for sin. There on Calvary's cross, his life was sacrificed, his blood was shed, and that sacrifice alone can enable us as vile sinners to approach God, to be reconciled to him. Hebrews 10, 12 and 14 says, "But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down on the right hand of God, for by one offering he hath perfected forever them that are sanctified." It's through the sacrifice of Christ alone that we are reconciled to God, that the problem of our sin is dealt with forever. Tell me tonight, is your faith and trust in the sacrifice of Christ alone? Because if it's not, if you're trusting in anything other than the perfect sacrifice of Christ, then your hopes for heaven are in vain. You will never ever be reconciled to God apart from faith in that once for all sacrifice for sin. All the works of your hands, all the sacrifices that you could ever make, are totally insufficient. The sacrifice of Christ alone, is that where your faith and trust is in tonight? So the prophet shows us here the greatness and the power of God and the glory and the holiness of God. But then thirdly, the prophet also shows us here the incomprehensibleness of the ways of God. Verses 13 to 14, he says, "Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding?" In these verses, the prophet shows us that the gospel is entirely from God. this great way of salvation from sin through the sacrifice of Christ alone, this is God's plan and his plan alone. There was no one who gave him counsel. There was no one who taught him and instructed him on how to do it. No, he planned and devised it all. That's what the prophet is telling us here. And because God is the one who planned this great plan of salvation, of course there are going to be some things about it that we will not understand or comprehend. There are things about it that will be beyond our comprehension. Why? Because it's God's plan and not ours. It's the infinite God dealing with the infinite problem of sin. So you can expect the miraculous. You can expect the incomprehensible. You can expect to be like Mary, who whenever the angel said to her that she was going to conceive a child in her womb, even though she was not married at that point, and that this child would be called the Son of the Highest, she asked, "How shall this be? How can this happen? I don't understand how this can happen." And what was the answer that was given to her? "For with God, nothing shall be impossible." This great and mighty God, whose ways are past finding out, he planned salvation's plan. He sent his only begotten Son into the world. He sent his Son to sacrifice himself, to give himself for us there on Calvary's cross. And even though you may not understand it all, how God could send his Son to the cross, how he could become your substitute, take your place and die for you so that you could go eternally free, or your little mind will not be able to understand that fully. But you just need to accept it, believe it, submit to it, trust in that finished work. The Apostle Paul quoted verses 13 and 14 here in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 16, where he says, "For who hath known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him?" Paul in that same passage had said, "For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God." You see, to the unconverted man or woman tonight, the cross, the message of the cross, it's foolishness. They can't understand it. How can someone dying upon a cross 2,000 years ago, how can that possibly do anything for us today? How can that make anyone right and acceptable with God? But you see, the cross of Christ was the wise plan of God alone. No one instructed him on how to do it. He didn't have anyone standing by his side there in eternity past telling him how to do it, telling him, "I think you should do it this way or you should do it that way." No, it all came from God alone. And our puny little finite minds will never be able to take it in. We will, our little minds are infinitely separated from the eternal mind and wisdom of God. "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Notice as we close tonight, the gospel is not man trying to reach up by its feeble efforts to reach God and attain God. No, the gospel is God himself coming down in the person of his Son, dying for us on a cross in shame, in weakness, and in suffering. Foolishness in the eyes of the world, yes, but unto us which believe, it's the power of God unto salvation. You may not, you will not understand it all. It's the infinite mind of God that planned it all. But just submit to it tonight. Believe it. That the almighty, all-powerful, all-glorious God that the prophet sets before us here, in his infinite wisdom, he planned this wondrous plan of salvation to send his only begotten Son into the world. And all you've got to do tonight when you recognize that you are infinitely separated from him because of your sin, is just to simply submit to what he has done for you, trust in the great provision that Christ has made for you on Calvary's cross, and receive this great salvation that he died to secure for you. I trust tonight, friend, that you will turn to Christ. You may not understand it all. You will not understand it all. But will you trust in him tonight? And what he has done for you. He shed his precious blood. He gave his life. He loved you. He gave himself for you. All that you may be saved by turning to him in simple faith, even tonight.